Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today. Coming up on the show, we have Alejandro Ramirez and Jessica Juarez, who will be here from the veterinary school at ISU to talk about a food animal summer experience designed to provide students with hands-on experience in vet science. And the annual meeting of Citizens for Community Improvement will take place on Saturday in Des Moines, and we'll be hearing from one of the speakers at that event. And lastly, Alex Fafar from the Ames Historical Society will be here to tell us about the Ames High exhibit, which will be closing soon, and the new exhibit opening up on grain elevators. But, of course, it's Friday, so before we get to all of that, we have Dennis Hart with the news roundup, and there is a lot in the news.
Indeed there is, Gail. Hello, everyone. Normally, we look back at the week's news through the pages of the Ames Tribune, and we are going to do that, but today is different. We're going to start with a summary of the tornadoes that rolled through part of central Iowa yesterday afternoon. At least five tornadoes broke out. Among other things, the twisters injured workers at a manufacturing plant in Pella, pulled apart buildings in Bondurant and Marshalltown. Among those damaged buildings, the historic Marshalltown Courthouse. Marshalltown suffered a direct hit from a tornado that roared through the downtown area late yesterday afternoon, ripping off the tops of buildings, flipping vehicles, and taking out trees and power lines. Among the damaged buildings, the Marshalltown Courthouse, which had part of its clock tower ripped off, the Lennox Industries Building, and Unity Point Hospital, where no patients or staff were injured, but which suffered structural damage. All 40 patients were evacuated to hospitals in Waterloo and Grundy Center. As many as 10 people were injured around Marshalltown, and a state of emergency was declared there. In Bondurant, which was hit first yesterday afternoon, at least 12 homes were damaged and trees and power lines came down. The area around Mallard Point Drive was blocked off last night because of gas leaks, and there were power outages all over the city. No injuries or deaths had been reported. Pella was the next area to receive major damage, and there were injuries there. 7 people were hurt at the Vermeer Corporation when a tornado hit that agricultural equipment manufacturing facility. 2 buildings there were demolished. The twister hit when the company was hosting an annual event that brought 400 customers to the plant from around the world. Winds flattened cornfields next to the Vermeer campus and set scrap metal and other debris into nearby fields. All of this, after forecasting models early yesterday morning showed only a slight chance of strong thunderstorms later in the day. What a day it turned out to be. Now let's look back at what made news this past week on the pages of the Ames Tribune. In last Saturday's Trib, it reported that a bolt of lightning struck 2 men outside a Colo golf course last Friday afternoon, sending both men to the hospital. The men, one of them in his 20s and the other in his 40s, were hit by lightning in the Twin Anchors golf course parking lot. Both had been standing outside a vehicle. Authorities said one bolt of lightning hit both of those men. No immediate update on their conditions. Also in Saturday's Trib, a story about Iowa Agriculture Secretary Mike Naig's visit to an Iowa State University research park in Boone County last week, where he showed up for a monarch butterfly conservation field day. While he was there, he asked farmers for patience despite a big downturn in commodity prices triggered by President Trump's $50 billion tariffs against Chinese goods. China has implemented the same amount of tariffs against such American goods as corn, pork, and soybeans. Naig said many farmers have already locked in prices for their harvest this year, but they could feel lots of pain if the low prices continue next year. Saturday's Tribune also reported that an Iowa State University graduate student is working hard to figure out a way to track the movement of monarch butterflies. Kelsey Fisher is using a technique called radio telemetry to determine how far away a monarch can recognize milkweed, which is the butterfly's natural habitat and the only plant that monarchs will lay their eggs on. Radio telemetry involves attaching transmitter tags to the butterflies to track their movements through different landscapes. The monarch butterfly population has gone way down over the past couple of decades, and researchers are trying to figure out ways to save it. Sunday's Trib had word that Ames police were investigating a sexual assault and an attempted sexual assault that had taken place on the west side of the city. One of them, the attempted assault, occurred 2 Sundays ago near Letty Street, when 2 men grabbed a woman and tried to pull her behind some buildings. The other took place a couple of Tuesdays ago, when a woman was sexually assaulted in the 300 block of Ash Avenue. Both incidents took place in the early morning hours, and in both cases, the women said 2 men were their assailants. Police said anyone out walking after dark should take a friend along. Sunday's Trib also reported that Story County officials were still collecting damage reports after heavy rains drenched the county last month. Roads were damaged, basements were flooded, and drainage systems were overwhelmed. Among the hardest hit, Kelly, where rain flooded yards, streets, and basements, and Maxwell, where some people ended up with as much as 5 feet of water in their basements. Sunday's Trib also had word that water was on the minds of Ames City Council members at a recent meeting. Council members were discussing water for the proposed industrial park east of the city, how much it would cost to provide, and what impact a large water user could have on the park. The city has approved spending $5 million to extend utilities, including water, to the 730-acre park, but City Engineer Tracy Warner told the council, if a company that needs a large amount of water decides to build at the park, the overall cost could rise from that $5 million to $14 million. One more note from Sunday's Trib, word that the Doran Clinic for Women in Ames was set to celebrate its 40th anniversary this past week. The clinic's lobby was filled with banners, memorabilia, and snacks in honor of that anniversary. The clinic was established in 1978 by John Doran and his son Robert. The Trib does not publish on Mondays. In Tuesday's edition, the top story was that a Nevada man who had pleaded guilty to smothering his infant daughter with a pillow was sentenced to 50 years in prison on Monday. Calvin Curtis White, who is 30 years old, will have to serve a minimum of 15 years before he becomes eligible for parole. White was arrested in February after he had been injured when he threw himself in front of a train in Nevada. In court on Monday, his wife Melissa called him a monster, said she would divorce him while he's in prison, and vowed to raise their son to be nothing like his father. Tuesday's Trib also reported that difficulties in acquiring land are delaying the city's ability to start building the Grand Avenue extension here in Ames. Some of the landowners in the planned construction area south of Lincoln Way are asking for more money for their land. Another landowner wants the property rezoned, and another says he won't work with the city at all. In addition, new costs have been added to the project's original $19.6 million estimated price tag, nearly $2.5 million in added costs. And to cap it off, the city has not received as much grant money as it hoped to have. Speaking of money, Tuesday's Trib reports that Iowa State University has been getting a lot of it from so-called external funding sources. Those sources include grants, contracts, and gifts from federal, state, and local governments, as well as from corporations and nonprofits. The university reports it received a record $509 million in total external funding in the most recent budget year that ended in June. That's the fourth year in a row that the university's external funding set a record. By comparison, the University of Iowa received $554 million in external funding, but that was a nearly $4 million drop from the year before. One more note from Tuesday's Tribune, and it's a big one. Ames City officials said there are some streets you may want to avoid this coming Tuesday when thousands of riders taking part in the Register's annual Great Bike Ride across Iowa will roll into town. Some of those riders will get here around 10 o'clock, but most will arrive between noon and 5. South Dakota, Mortenson, and Beach, as well as the area around Jack Trice Stadium and around Brookside Park, going to be jammed with riders, and vehicle traffic will be restricted or limited. The best way to figure out which parts of which roads will be affected is to read the long takeout in Tuesday's Trib. Something else to note about RAGBRAI, downtown Ames is going to serve as the main hub for the event's entertainment on Tuesday night. There will be music, jugglers, stilt walkers, even fire eaters. And after all that, RAGBRAI's estimated 20,000 riders will roll out of town early Wednesday morning, heading through Nevada and Colo on their way to an overnight stop in Newton. Wednesday Trib reported that the Ames City Council had quite a time of it Tuesday night, but finally passed the second reading of an ordinance allowing some rental hardship exemptions to homeowners in the 7 neighborhoods where the council has previously placed a 25% cap on rental properties. After all was said and done, and it was complicated, the council agreed that any rental permit obtained under the rental cap exemption could not be transferred through the sale of the property. But homes transferred through inheritance or other non-sale processes would be able to keep their rental permits and could continue to hold tenants. The third and final reading and adoption of this complicated ordinance will come before the council in a few weeks. Wednesday's Trib also reported on Tuesday's Story County Board of Supervisors meeting where the board approved a home business permit for a wood service company near Kelly. Board members also agreed to increase the hourly wage for the county's temporary election workers from $10.50 an hour to $15 an hour for the November general election. Wednesday's Trib also had word that the Ballard and Collins-Maxwell school boards have both agreed to share a superintendent for one more year. Audie Maxey has been named the shared superintendent for the past couple of years, and he will continue in that role this coming school year. And the Colonesco school board welcomed new superintendent Jim Walker during Monday night's meeting. Thursday's Tribune reported that two finalists are in the running to take over as the next fire chief in Ames. One of them is Rich Higgins, who has been the deputy fire chief here since 2012 and is now the interim chief. The other candidate is a former Davenport fire chief, Lynn Washburn Livingston. She was fired from her Davenport job last year for, among other things, excessive travel time and time away from duties. She appealed her dismissal and a court case is pending. Both Washburn Livingston and Higgins will give public presentations here in Ames. Hers will be next Thursday at 4 o'clock at the City Council Chambers. Higgins will give his public presentation on August 13th at the Council Chambers. Thursday's Trib also reported that the City Council is in the early stages of talking about possibly moving Fire Station Number 2, the one on Welch Avenue in Campustown. The current location is not ideal because Welch is busy, as you know, being right in the heart of Campustown, and it's tough to get fire trucks in and out of the existing building. Thursday's Trib also had word that an Ames man who was arrested last August for sexually assaulting a woman has been given a suspended sentence and 2 years probation. 34-year-old Clarence Castile will also have to register as a sex offender. He had pleaded guilty to assault with intent to commit sexual abuse. He's been given credit for the time he's already served in custody. And one more note from Thursday's Trib, volunteers are still needed here in Ames for next Tuesday's arrival of those bike riders taking part in RagBri. As of Wednesday, 250 volunteer positions were still not filled, but the RagBri committee was hoping there would be a surge of last-minute volunteers. Today's Trib, Fridays, reports that a member of the group that allegedly robbed a man last summer at a Campustown ATM has now been charged with assaulting a jail inmate. 18-year-old Isaiah Zion Lewis of Anamosa allegedly punched the inmate at least twice in the face, then stomped the inmate's head into the concrete floor several times. His first trial on the robbery charge set to start next month. Today's Trib also reports on the Iowa Summer Games, which take place in Ames this weekend. That's an annual sporting event that is open to all Iowa athletes. Opening ceremonies are set for this evening, 7:45 at Jack Trice Stadium. More than 12,000 athletes expected to take part. And one more note, the Trib has a feature story today about an Ames teenager who has opened her own home bakery and who is selling her creations at the farmer's market in Ames on Saturdays, and who is donating part of her profits to charities in her home country. 14-year-old Zoe Lee's home country is the Democratic Republic of the Congo in Africa, and you can read all about her and her story in today's Tribune. And that, wow, is your summary of events from a busy week indeed, Gail, in Ames and around central Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart. I'll be back here Wednesday morning with a look at news from the pages of several nearby newspapers around Ames. What a week and what a day yesterday.
Yeah, thanks for summarizing it all for us, Dennis.
Pleasure to be here. See you soon.
Look for the bare necessities, the simple bare necessities. Forget about your worry and your strife. I mean the bare necessities, oh, Mother Nature's recipe that brings the bare necessities of life. Wherever I wander, wherever I roam, I could be fonder of my big home. Make some honey just for me. When you look under the rocks and plants, then take a glance at the fancy ants, and maybe try a few. The bare necessities of a life will come to you. They'll come to you. Look for the bare necessities, the simple bare necessities. Forget about your worry and your strife. I mean, the bare necessities of life. Wherever I wander, wherever I roam, I couldn't be fonder of my big home. The bees are buzzing in the trees to make some honey. When you look under the rocks and plants, then take a glance at the fancy ants, and maybe try a few of the bare necessities of life. The necessities of life, the bare necessities of life will come to you. They'll come to you. They'll come to you. The bare necessities.
That was Maddie Pope, the recent American Idol winner from Clarksville, Iowa, singing The Bare Necessities from The Jungle Book. This is Local Talk on KHOI 89.1 FM. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm your host, Gail Seiler. And we now have with us some new guests. We have Alejandro, or Alex, I guess you go by, Ramirez, a professor in ISU's veterinary school, and Jessica, or Jesse, Juarez from the Department of Animal Science at ISU. And we have two students, undergrad students, Yahira Rhodes and Daniela Gatica. So thank you all for coming in.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
We invited you here to talk about this interesting summer program, the Food Animal Summer Experience. So let's start by just telling us what that program is and what it's intended to do.
All right, so the program is a 10-week program for animal science or anyone in an undergraduate program. We have 7 animal science students and 1 animal ecology major that are participating in this program. It's designed for 40-hour week experience. In the mornings, the students go out to the animal science farms and work with all the major species, dairy, beef, sheep, swine, and poultry. Then in the afternoons, they spend approximately 4 hours at the School of Veterinary Medicine job shadowing and observing what veterinarians do within all the different areas of veterinary medicine.
And the program is particularly targeted for students of color because they have often have difficulty getting this kind of experience, which is required for vet school admissions. Is that correct?
That is correct. So veterinary experience, along some lines, is very much highly valued when applying to veterinary school. So underrepresented students oftentimes have barriers to gaining that experience. One of the major barriers is geographical location and availability of being able to obtain veterinary experience and job shadowing. One of the second barriers, too, is also the lack of diversity currently in veterinary medicine. And so many of the students also would like to identify with veterinarians of color and have that mentorship and relationship, and there's not a lot of that available currently. So this program is designed to help bring the students into the veterinary profession and bring that mentorship to them.
And just a few more specifics about the program. How long does it last, and do the students live on campus, or how does that work?
The program is 10 weeks long, 40 hours a week. It's designed to get 400 hours of quality animal and veterinary experience, 200 hours of each. And the students do live in campus housing. They live in Frederickson Court in apartment-style housing. They also get food stipend provided as well.
And how is this funded?
So, yes, I will speak to that. Okay. So, currently, since this is a new program, this is the first year we're executing.
Uh-huh.
The dean of the College of Vet Med, Dr. Pat Halber, has been quite generous to use some of his funds to start this program this year and just establish, you know, the success of it and determine whether in the future we can execute and probably be seeking some funding for it in the future.
And maybe even to expand it with additional funding.
That would be great.
And who was the originator of this program? Like, where did the idea come from that there was a need for this?
Yes. So it really started as a veterinary profession. We've been very aware of the lack of diversity in our profession. I think there was an article in the Atlantic magazine like in 2013 that identified the veterinary profession as the whitest profession. I think at that time, if you look at the data from the veterinary side, our profession is like 90-plus percent white. And I think there's only like 5% Hispanic and maybe 2% African American, percentage-wise. So it's really lacks that diversity, ethnicity that it's important, that we realize is important. With that, Iowa State being in Iowa, we don't have a lot of diversity as other states. So also Iowa State, if we look at our data, our school, I think last year, out of all the 545 students that we might only have 26 students that would be considered diverse. So that would be 5% or so. Currently, in all veterinary schools, I think the number is closer to 17%. So last year, Iowa State was probably out of 30 veterinary schools at the very bottom of the list in diversity. We have very diverse faculty. We just lack that diversity in students. So our dean has been very proactive to how do we increase that pipeline to get that exposure? What are those barriers and how can we facilitate that process?
So there certainly is a need for it.
There's absolutely a big need for that.
So let's hear from two of our aspiring veterinarians who may be able to change that in the future. So let me turn to Yahira and Daniela. Maybe just tell us first, why do you want to become a vet? What got you interested in that?
My name is Daniela. I feel that animals bring a lot of joy to a lot of people, and I want to be a part of continuing that tradition, finding ways to better medicine, and being able to continue that relationship so that families and people can benefit from having pets in their homes, pets in their lives as assistance animals, as emotional support animals. I think that's a really important thing that we're finding that really truly helps increase the quality of life that people experience. And I want to be a part of that, and I am very interested in the medicine side as well as the people side. It brings me a lot of joy just to see how happy people are and the emotional side of what animals can bring to people's lives.
So my name is Yahida, and I've basically been interested in becoming a vet since I was young. I'm from Texas, and the State Fair of Texas is a huge thing. Like, I've always loved it. We've gone every single year, and there's always a really big, like, food animal side, and there's a whole bunch of barns and stuff, and I was always walking through and seeing there's always a vet there on staff to kind of see how animals are doing and stuff like that, and I was like, wow, that's something I'm really interested in. And then as I grew older and came to the school, I realized that I was really interested in doing like conservation veterinary medicine and working kind of in places like Africa and stuff like that, and working on animals that are maybe on the endangered species list and coming up with different medicine and things like that to make sure that we ensure that our populations are still increasing, because these are gorgeous and amazing animals that we don't want to basically die off because they're on the endangered species list and need just a little bit more assistance. So for me, it's about providing the assistance and the medicine that's needed to make sure that we have these animals that have been around for forever.
It sounds like you're coming at veterinary medicine really from very different interests, from a more personal pet interest, but I never thought about conservation in terms of veterinary science as an area. Tell us about one particular thing you've learned or experienced so far in the summer program that's been really meaningful to you.
For me, just kind of going to vet med, I started off with the food animal rotation. And so that was just a really interesting experience to me to kind of see how all the doctors in there were very helpful. And basically, it's not even just the animal side of it, but that every doctor in there, because there's different rotations, there's a whole bunch of doctors in the vet med school, of course, was always interested in helping out. It was the people side as well, in that, yes, everyone was interested in making sure the animals were okay, but that you could always have another doctor come in, look at things. Everyone was willing to help and give assistance and kind of make sure that they all had an end goal, and that was animal health and welfare.
Yeah, I think a lot of what Yahida said is really important, too. I think another really valuable point of this program is just exposure in general. It's one thing to hear about specifics about this animal or this specialty, but it's a completely different thing to be immersed in that and to be in the vet school, like seeing these different specialties and these different doctors and students doing what could be our future on a daily basis, really seeing what those daily tasks are, what those appointments look like, what those cases look like, and being opened up to a whole new world that we really know very little about as undergrad students, as students in general. It's totally new when it's right in front of you.
And in your majors at ISU, do you also see the same lack of diversity as students of color? Do you see that lack of diversity that Dr. Ramirez was speaking of?
I think it is a very predominantly white major, especially at our university. I can't speak for all universities, but I know we do experience it. I think we do tend to find each other, and we're able to rely on each other and share in each other's experiences as people of color. But I think there is definitely a lack there, and we could definitely grow in that area as a university.
You mentioned that there's diversity in the faculty at the vet school. That's surprising to me.
Sometimes we don't think of that diversity as existing as much. But I think one of the key things when you look at faculty is our pool that we can bring to an institution like Iowa State can be international and throughout the U.S. So there are great opportunities to bring people with different backgrounds. Because of the most people get movable or are very movable when they're looking for employment compared to a student population that mm-hmm. relies more heavily on what's locally
the
available.
The local university.
Yes.
Now talking to the professors, what can you tell us about your experiences as people of color coming into veterinary science? How did you get involved?
So that's a good question. So I'm half American, half Mexican. Grew up in Mexico. Grew up in a city, so really didn't have much exposure to livestock. Had some exposure through my dad's brothers who had a cattle farm. So really a city boy, my mom took the best of the vet, so I really had zero exposure to veterinary medicine down there. So when I turned 18, having the opportunity to come to the U.S., my mom from Iowa, interested in agriculture, came to Iowa State and really was not thinking about even veterinary medicine. When I met with my advisor here in animal science the first semester, she said, well, are you pre-vet? And I just looked at her and I said, yes, I am.
Maybe.
Good idea. But I think it was just that lack of exposure, lack of opportunities. I enjoyed going out to the ranch with my uncles, but the vet would come out, you know, once a year. And that was my exposure to veterinary medicine. So it's a passion of helping with animals, like Daniela said, a passion of medicine that then come together and you say, yes, this is something, but I really hadn't had that exposure. First time I ever stepped into a veterinary clinic was actually my senior year of vet school. So I'd already entered the profession or was about to graduate, and that was my first real experience. So throughout the whole time, I really haven't felt any different. There's always things that I think you just grow up to just know that you just keep rolling and moving forward, right? And I think it's more, I always take it upon myself to, I get a lead, right? If there's a lack of diversity, I can't expect it to be ready there for me when I start, but mm-hmm. I just need to jump in there, lead, and do the best I can to demonstrate our capabilities and our ability to fit in well into the profession.
And start programs like this.
And then start creating that pipeline.
Jesse?
Being originally from Southwest Iowa, Glenwood, Iowa, there was not a lot of veterinary exposure growing up. I was very actively involved in 4-H and FFA and found my passion for animal agriculture through those programs. Did have the opportunity in high school to job shadow a veterinary clinic. Fell in love with the aspect of helping people through animals, and that has been kind of my driving force. When I got to Iowa State in animal science, I realized the ability to help feed the world through animals and through agriculture, and that really stuck with me. Went to veterinary school and then came back out, practiced for a while, and came back to Iowa State.
Dr. Ramirez, I noticed on the website that you teach a course called Spanish for Veterinarians.
Yes.
Tell us about why it's important.
So actually, when I became a faculty at Iowa State in the College of Vet Med, I had students who came to me and said, hey, we've taken Spanish, but we really need something a little bit more related to how do we connect with the Hispanic Latin population that's working on farms or bringing in their pets. and what are the terminologies that you would use as a veterinarian, not scientific, but lay stuff that really is not taught in a regular Spanish course. So with that, I got some help and we created the Spanish for Veterinarian course that focuses, again, on the terminology, communication, and then also trying to understand the cultures, right? So when, as people communicate, I'm a strong believer that if you start opening up and try to speak, they'll open up and they'll actually speak a lot more English and understand a lot more English than if you just say, hey, you got to speak English or I can't communicate. Because ultimately our goal is to help the animals, but we got to go through the people to help those animals.
And it's often those people who are caring for the animals, whether they're ill or calving or whatever. So it's important that they can communicate with the veterinary people.
Yes, exactly. And then that they connect too, right? Yeah. Because it's like a human doctor. You know, if you don't connect with them, you're likely not to tell them some of the other things that you want to speak to them. So the same, we want them to talk to us about their needs of their animals so that we can make sure we can address those needs.
So even in Iowa, being bilingual as possible is an asset in veterinary medicine, it sounds like.
We sure hope.
I think we'll have to wrap it up there, but thank you so much for coming in and telling us about this.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with folks from the Veterinary Medicine School about the Food Animal Summer Experience at ISU. And you are listening to Local Talk on KHOI FM. CCI, or Citizens for Community Improvement, is holding their 2018 convention in Des Moines on Saturday. The theme of this year's event is A Future Worth Fighting For. One of the workshop presenters is Kevin Simowitz, political director of Caring Across Generations. They are a national initiative to transform long-term care in the U.S.
National campaign working to transform the way that we care in the United States. Our mission is to build a new care infrastructure in the U.S. that works for people who are providing care, family caregivers and paid home care workers, as well as people who are receiving care, older adults and people with disabilities.
So that'll be the basis for the main points of your workshop that you'll be doing?
That's right. I'm going to talk about the care that they and their families want and deserve, and then we're going to talk together about what it looks like to sort of build the political system and amass the political power that we need to actually win that care.
It says that you're fighting against unequal access to care, excessive institutionalization, and widespread cultural ageism.
It's important probably to set the context a little bit of the changing demographics of the country. So every 8 seconds, someone in the United States turns 65 years old, which means that about 10,000 people a day, or about 4 million people a year, turn 65. And when people are asked where they would like to sort of age and receive care as they get older, about 90% of seniors say that they would like to receive that care in their home or their community if they have the option. We know that across the country, Medicare, which is the healthcare program for seniors, for the most part, doesn't pay for home and community-based care. So when people get older and need home healthcare, there are really only two ways to access that. One is to pay out of pocket, and the national average is somewhere around $50,000 a year for a year of home health care, or people spend down their assets to qualify for Medicaid. Medicaid is the largest provider of home and community-based services in the country, so people qualify for Medicaid, and then they're able to access home care that way. However, they also have to get rid of or spend down their life savings, often transferring ownership of their home if they owned a home to someone else in the family. It's not really a system at all. And so when we think about what it looks like to make sure that people are able to stay at home as they get older and access care in their home and in their communities from really well-trained and really well-paid home health care professionals, we know that first and foremost, that means protecting Medicaid. We absolutely need to make sure that Medicaid isn't privatized, and in states like Iowa where Medicaid has been privatized, to go back to a system that actually puts people in front of profits. every other day in the newspaper, we see the harmful effects of Medicaid privatization on seniors and people with disabilities in Iowa. And then we also need to talk about what it looks like to expand access to home and community-based services in a way that doesn't just rely on the Medicaid system. Because Medicaid was never set up to be the home and community-based service provider for everyone. It was really meant to do that for people who had low incomes. And so we have to figure out a new care infrastructure that allows people to access home and community-based care or transportation services or home modification that doesn't just rely on people impoverishing themselves to qualify for Medicaid. And that's where we talk about building a new care infrastructure, one that could be part of a vision for single-payer healthcare, or one that could look like the proposals that we've seen in Washington State or in Maine right now about a universal long-term care program that exists on its own. But we really first and foremost need to make sure that Medicaid's a system that works and, again, is putting the healthcare needs of seniors and people with disabilities first instead of the profit margins of private insurance companies, and then pivot towards a real vision for what it looks like to make sure people can access this care when they need it. So we feel very open to a variety of pathways to getting to affordable care for seniors and people with disabilities through a system that provides more support for families. Family caregivers provide, the estimate is around 80% of the home health care that's provided in the country, so we need a system that supports them. And a system that creates lots more quality caregiving jobs and pays those jobs fair wages and offers career development opportunities for home health care workers. So we could see many different pathways to achieving that vision, but we know what's most important is to have a vision that touches on all those things together.
With 10,000 people every day turning 65, not everyone is going to be able to have family support, and it has to be devastating, even to people that have, you know, a moderate income, that they're going to possibly lose all their assets, all their savings, all their maybe their home and everything they work for their entire life.
That's right. We've seen what happens to people when they have to leave the workforce to provide care for usually a parent or a grandparent. On average, family caregivers lose out on about $300,000 over the course of a lifetime in lost wages and retirement security. Because, of course, if you leave the workforce, you're losing your Social Security tax credits, too. And we also know that this is an issue that primarily affects women. 90% of the care in the United States is provided by women. So we know that when people leave the paid workforce to become unpaid family caregivers, we know that's usually women who are leaving behind their Social Security tax credits to take care of an older parent or grandparent. And we've got to build a new system that speaks to that gender inequity.
I have a family member that I've been a caregiver for most of my life. And it's a very large burden. Even though I care very much for that family member, I don't want them to think that they are a burden for me. It does, you know, affect my income. It affects my well-being at times. And I
really appreciate your bringing it into the conversation, because so many of us have these personal connections to this issue. Someone said very poignantly to me in Michigan last year, she was taking care of her father. And she said, "I don't need it to be easy. I just didn't think it would be this hard." That there is some joy in her being able to care for her father. And there are parts that are tough, and she wouldn't trade those parts either. But I feel like sometimes the choices feel a little bit too impossible for family caregivers, and the burden shouldn't be quite so heavy.
For me, one of the biggest burdens is always having to fill out tons of paperwork and try to coordinate with my family member to be with me at the same time I'm trying to, you know, get their appointments lined up for medical care and dental care and things like that. And
people have phenomenally better health outcomes when they're able to age in their own homes or their communities. But the system is really set up to incentivize care in nursing homes or long-term care facilities. And to be clear, there are some people who would choose to receive care in those facilities, and we want them to be able to do that. But what we don't want to happen is for people who would receive better health outcomes if they were at home, who want to be at home, be forced into facilities or nursing homes because the system is set up with a bias towards reimbursing long-term care in a facility instead of long-term care at home. It doesn't really work for anybody except the people who make money off of a long-term care system that exists in facilities and nursing homes.
How do you hope that your organization keeps up with this large amount of people retiring and still getting quality care?
For us at Caring Across and for our partners at Iowa CCI, sort of think about this in three big buckets. And the first one is to kind of protect what we have, which in the protect what we have category, we talk about really advocating again for making sure that the Medicaid system is a system that works for everyone, that is a system that the government controls rather than private interests, and that people who qualify for Medicaid are able to access the care that they need. The second thing that we've talked about doing is this idea of demanding what we need. And I think we've got to be realistic that system is not going to look the same for everybody. So we need something that's nimble and flexible, that allows people to get what they need and that changes as what they need changes too. And the third thing that we talk a lot about doing is bringing this issue into the political arena and making sure that anybody who's running for office at the city or county level, all the way up to people who are going to run for president in 2020 and everyone in between, that anyone running for office should have to tell voters what their long-term plan is for long-term care. Because the crisis in this country is not that people are getting older. The crisis is that our elected officials haven't built a care infrastructure to keep up with our care needs. And so anytime someone's campaigning, they should really be talking about what they're going to do to make sure that we recruit more home health care workers, and we pay the home care workers who are in the workforce right now a fair wage, and we support family caregivers, and we increase access to care for older adults and people with disabilities. And so bringing this into the campaigns, which are the biggest public conversation we have in this country about what it is we want and what it is we value, is another way for us to make sure that more and more people realize that they're not alone in their caregiving situation and that others want the same thing that they want too.
Okay, and so it sounds really interesting. How will you make people care about this issue? What's your vision to make people care about this?
Pretty much all families are either dealing with this issue right now or getting ready to deal with it in the coming 2 or 3 years. And so unlike a lot of other issues where there's a bit of an uphill climb to get people to understand it and to care about it, when I start talking with people on issues of long-term care, my role is usually pretty quickly to be quiet and listen to them tell me about what it's been like to try to find affordable home care for their mom or dad while they try to remain in the workforce and protect their own retirement security. Mm-hmm. Or from home health care workers who talk about how much they care about the people that they're spending every day with and how hard it is to do that work for such low wages, wages that are so low that they can't provide for their own families. The inequities baked into the system, preventing home health care workers from accessing things like minimum wage protections up until a couple of years ago. Home health care work is work done primarily by women, often mm-hmm. by women of color. On average, nationwide, home care workers earn $13,000 a year. Mm. I didn't misspeak, $13,000 a year, because most home health care workers can't get 40 hours a week of work. Many are paid under the table and don't earn a minimum wage in the states where they're working. And of course, home health care workers have faced systemic inequities that are no accident. And the way that we know from many, many, many studies to retain home health care workers is to pay them a fair wage. What we hear most from seniors who are receiving home health care that they want is they want consistency. That makes mm-hmm. sense.
Right.
People are doing, you know, really emotional work and also really intimate work. And people want to continue to develop the bond that they develop with someone. When people who are providing home health care can't afford food and care for their own kids and their own families, those home care workers are not going to be able to stay at a job that doesn't pay them a fair wage. So making sure that people are paid $15 an hour and have access to a union, those are really systemic changes that we can make to ensure mm-hmm. that the workforce meets the need of those, that increasing number of aging adults in the country. And so the real challenge is not so much in getting people to care. It's in helping understand that the problem in long-term care right now doesn't need to be an individual problem, and that there's a systemic failure at play that's letting everyone down. I talked to a lot of families who feel like they've done something wrong, or I heard someone tell me once that she felt like she had missed a day in school because she just didn't know how to access the care that her and her family needed. And one of the things that we talk a lot about at Caring Across Generations is moving these conversations that are happening at people's kitchen tables all across the country into town halls and making sure that we understand this challenge as not an individual challenge that families should face one by one, but something that we need to demand better from our political system and our public infrastructure to help meet everyone's care needs.
So if you have these town hall meetings, how do you keep them focused and actually causing action?
It's important to make sure that when we're having town hall meetings, elected officials and people who are making decisions about public policy are there. And lately, I think we've seen more and more elected officials making decisions that are really harmful. Iowa's Medicaid privatization,
yes.
People who have been responsible for those decisions, skipping town hall conversations and skipping public forums where they would need to sit with families and look people in the eye who have been cut off from the services that they need provided by Medicaid. One of the most important things that I hear when I'm in these settings is people demanding really bold, really visionary solutions from their elected officials. When people start talking about what they need, not just what someone told them was politically possible, not mm-hmm. just what seems like the incremental step that someone told them they could take this year and then we'll take another one next year. But when people stand up and say what they and their family need to survive and to thrive in today's economy, I think that's really powerful. And I think it's important to actually push elected officials and candidates for elected office to hear not just what might be able to get done with the current legislature, but to hear where people want us to go together as a community and then talk about what it takes to get there.
Well, I want to thank you very much. I think this is extremely important. Do you have contact information for your organization?
Sure. The best way to get in touch with me or to learn more about Caring Across Generations is to visit our website, which is caringacross.org, caringacross.org. And of course, if you're not already signed up for the Iowa CCI email list to stay in tune with everything that's happening right here in Iowa, the Iowa CCI website is iowacci.org. That's just iowacci.org. And so between the Iowa CCI and the Caring Across Generations website, you'll find all the contact information that you need.
That was Kevin Simowitz, who is one of the presenters at the meeting tomorrow of Citizens for Community Improvement, CCI, which will be held in Des Moines. Thanks to Joy and Ursula for bringing us that interview. You're listening to Local Talk. And now, here for his monthly segment, is Alex Fafar from the Ames Historical Society. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning, Gail. Thanks for having me today.
Sure. You're going to tell us about an exhibit that's only going to be up for a short while longer, so people need to get in there to see it if they're interested.
Yeah, we've been talking a lot when I've been coming in about Ames High. We have it, Ames High, Aiming High Through the Years has been our feature exhibit since November and will be coming down on August 11th, so just a little bit less than a month to come in and see that before it's down here. I thought we'd talk a little bit about a little chunk of it maybe to
okay.
kind of bring tell a little bit of a full story. You know, we have a lot of words on our wall over the Historical Society, so we have to be careful about not putting too many on. So sometimes we don't get
you
to tell.
You can't put all the stories
We can't
up
put
there.
All the stories
all right,
on
so those. Give so us a different one.
Yeah, sometimes we even have to just kind of cut them down a little bit so people get the hint of it. But we're going to talk a little bit about, very appropriate, locations for high school with the new one going up that's going to be on the current site where they're just going to kind of flip everything around.
Piggyback one on top of the other for a while.
Yeah,
sort of.
Kind of shuffle the deck around, see where they can put everything. So let's talk a little bit about the Ames High School number 3, which is the current City Hall building. So that was the Ames High School from the the late 30s to the early 60s. So we're going to talk a little bit about the troubles they were having going for the location. So in 1937, the school board voted for a new school with a 4-1 vote to build a new building. On a 20-acre plot, they were looking at an area by 13th Street west of Grand, kind of the 13th and Ridgewood area. There's a little triangle cut shape of land there to try to build like a campus type school, like the kind of like the current Ames High School, actually, the one that they're looking at tearing down. But there were a few people in town that didn't like that idea. There was a fourth ward committee that was made up of people living in West Ames, and they kind of raised a little bit of about the location being too far away. You hear that sometimes about when they build these schools in town, that it's, oh, you're building it on the edge of town, too far away. I believe they said the same thing about Roosevelt Elementary, and that quickly became in the center of town. So they suggested, this Fourth Ward Committee, other sites, mounted an active campaign against the school board's choice. And the leader of this Fourth Ward Committee was Professor E.C. McCracken, who had moved to Ames just 2 years earlier. So they were kind of wrestling with where it should go, and they brought in an outside consultant, and they both strongly recommended this 13th and Grand site again. And it was suggested that the school board purchase 40 or 50 acres of adjoining land, also for athletic fields. So they were thinking about that too. Now, it's important to remember that the high school that they were using before 1937 was what most people call Central Junior High East. So that is the one that was in the parking lot just, on the east side of City Hall. And that was torn down in the 80s. But that was our high school from 1911. To when they built the City Hall building. So when the students were there, they had to cross all the way across Lincoln Way to the Hy-Vee Lincoln Center is where the athletic fields were.
Oh.
So a few blocks away, it wasn't as convenient as just being on site. They had to walk across Lincoln Way with, you know, railroad tracks that used to go through there and everything. So not the greatest option. So there was really, they were trying to get those athletic fields and everything kind of all together, but McCracken's committee protested and the vote to support the old Clark School location. So the school board, in spite of having the authority to just make the decision themselves, let the citizens decide in a referendum.
Hmm.
Yeah, kind of unusual, isn't
it?
Like they
wanted
to make sure they weren't doing the wrong thing and they'd get heat for it for a long time. So on March 8th, 1937, the Clark Street location won by a 299 vote. And the school board president, W.H. Root, was also unseated by a Fourth Ward candidate by 17 votes. So thus, the high school stayed in Central Ames like the West Committee wanted. It became a landlocked school. As you know about the City Hall building, they never put any additions onto that. It's just a square building with a courtyard in the center. And so they still had to cross Lincoln Way to go to the athletics for many, many years. So the issue with that is that this school, built in 1939, never was able to be added onto. It really quickly outgrew its size that it needed, and so it's actually the shortest-lived Ames High School. It barely lasted 20 years before they had to build a new one north of town like they probably should have in the 1930s. The ironic thing about this is that Professor McCracken, the one that was really kind of the one behind getting it to stay in Central Ames, He moved out of Ames in 1938 before the high school even opened.
That's bizarre.
Right? Yeah, you kind of find that funny that he never he was only here for like, what, 3 years, like, and he really sure wanted that school in the center.
He had an impact.
He had an impact, that's for sure. You know, fast forward to the 90s when City Hall moves in there as we get the junior highs move out of the building and all move down kind of towards the West Ames area. We eventually get a nice City Hall out of it and probably a new and more appropriate purpose for the building being downtown. So
that is interesting that the community was given a voice but maybe didn't make the best decision.
Probably not. Yeah, given that it only lasted about 20 years, it probably cost, they didn't want to build that school as soon as they had to, I don't think. But also, you know, post-World War II population booms also affected it a little bit too, so it didn't last as long as it maybe they thought it was going to.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, very interesting story there,
okay,
nonetheless.
So if people want to see that high school exhibit, they have until August 11th.
Yes, August 11th.
But then quickly tell us about the upcoming exhibit.
Yeah, so replacing that, we're going to have an exhibit about grain elevators. So this is a photo series done by a local photographer, Judith Eastman. She takes photographs of old abandoned grain elevators in Iowa, and I believe there's a couple that are in Kansas. So some that are from around the area, like Boxholm is one that's on there, and Fraser. And so we're going to display some of her nicely framed photographs, and then we're also going to have a little sidewall that's going to have the story of basically the Fronting and Depe elevator that some people might remember being on the east end of Main Street at Duffin, Maine. It was, most people remember it because it was famously burned down in 1977 for a fire training exercise, and it was just a huge fire. I mean, it was a big skyscraper that was an icon at the end of Main Street, kind of down with the power plant. You just always saw those two together. So we're going to tell the story of that building and kind of the roots of grain elevators in Ames.
And that will be a photo exhibit. And it opens when?
That'll open on August 17th. So we have it'll be just a little bit after
transition
the
there.
Little transition. Yeah, a little shorter than we usually do since we're not building an entire full exhibit like we usually do since the photo series will be up there. So this will be a lot shorter time between exhibits, but it'll be great. The grain elevators will only be up for 6 weeks. It's a shorter one.
Oh, so people will need to get in there.
They will need to, yes.
And remind us again, location and hours of the Ames History Center.
Yes. So we're at 416 Douglas at the corner of 5th and Douglas, and we are open from 10 to 4 on Tuesdays through Saturdays.
Thank you very much,
Thank
Alex.
You, Gail. We'll see you next month.
All right. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can listen to today's show and all of our past shows online at khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Jackie Norman. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards. And we also heard The Bare Necessities by Maddie Pope. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening and see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. The Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun every Saturday, located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza. The Farmers Market brings fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment.